Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we're all about sports. My guests are Ron Swoboda, author of Here's the Catch, a memoir of the Miracle Mets and more, and Derby Gisclair, author of The Olympic Club of New Orleans, epicenter of professional boxing, 1883 to 1897, and early baseball in New Orleans. Many New Orleanians know Ron Swoboda from his work as a sportscaster on WVUE or as a color commentator for the New Orleans Baby Cakes. And many know that he had a rich, full life in baseball before moving to the Crescent City. That's the story he tells in his wonderful new memoir, Here's the Catch, a memoir of the Miracle Mets and more. Ron Swoboda, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Miss Susan. Nice to be here.
I feel I should call you Swoboda, like Casey Stengel.
I answer to that. I answer to Fumbats, which was a code word when you were playing baseball and your wife or someone vital needed to get your attention down on the field. You needed a code word that no one else was yelling.
Oh, I'm honored you shared.
I've let you in. I've let you very in.
Now, this book is so much fun to read. It's the perfect summer book. It's funny and it's smart, and there's kind of sweetness to it as well. So talk a little bit about finally sitting down to actually do it.
Well, you know, like everything, you know, baseball is a game of stories. And my life has been unconventional in so many ways that I think in and of itself engenders stories. You know, mm-hmm. nothing was planned. And everything sort of just happened, but you chased the best efforts you could, and you put out the best effort you could, and you look back in 50 years, and you went, wow, I lived a pretty interesting life. But I wasn't compelled to write. You know, when I hear people say, I've got a right to live, I'm like, I tell these stories, I've told these stories, but to write them down, I hadn't. I spent a bunch of years writing things in New Orleans for New Orleans Magazine, thanks mm-hmm. to Errol Laborde, and loved it. It ended right at Katrina. They kind of went in a different direction, and that was over. I wrote all my stuff as a sports guy for 20 years, here or there, and mostly in New Orleans. So I felt like if I had to put these down, I could find the voice, but I didn't feel compelled. And, mm-hmm. and Rob Kuig, a good friend, said, you know, you need to start writing this stuff down. You need to turn this into a book. And I was like, really? And and finally, he got around to the impeccable logic part. He said, if you don't write all this stuff down in time for the 50th anniversary of the 1969 New York Mets, you're not selling it to anybody. And I went, you just made a good point. I get that.
Spoken like the businessman he is.
He is indeed. And he made it make sense to me. And so I started writing some stuff with a good friend who is a New Orleans guy on the edges. I've lost touch with John Stinson, who... Mm-hmm. is a guy who really has studied writing and understands it. And we wrote a big pile of stuff. And at one point, John just stepped away. And I have not had a conversation with him at that point. But I had this mass of stuff. And I finally got connected with a guy through an agent in New York, Jamie Malinowski, who's a speechwriter for Andrew Cuomo, the governor. Uh-huh. And Jamie, I said, I need somebody to find a book in all this pile of stuff, because uh-huh. I don't know what a book looks like. I wrote little columns and you know, 4-minute sportscasts on television. Yeah. I don't know what a book is.
It's a long haul.
This isn't War and Peace, which I said to a guy at the Met Fantasy Camp I go to every year, and he goes, that's good because maybe I'll get through it. So I had some stuff, and I had too much stuff, and not in the right order or written the. So I started putting it down the way it needed to go, and Jamie helped me organize this thing in a way that turned into this book.
So you're coming up on this very special anniversary, this 50th anniversary, and this book is such a great tribute to that moment. But what will you actually do to mark that anniversary?
There's going to be a big gathering of all of us who are capable of appearing at Citi Field in New York or who want to be there. Not everybody wants to be there.
Yeah.
Our little second baseman, Kenny Boswell, declined. Tom Seaver, our Hall of Fame pitcher, without whom none of this happens, without whom I'm not wearing this ring, is suffering dementia and doesn't travel.
Mm-hmm.
There's five or six of us who have passed away who are not here anymore. Don Clendenin, Tommy Agee, Tug McGraw, my favorite.
Yeah.
I loved him. And a few other guys that just aren't, you know, they're not with us anymore.
Well, there should be a quiz on this book. We'll see. One of the things I loved about this book is that it's such an all-American memoir. It's a story of growing up, and, you know, even your name translates to freedom, which I think is so interesting. But it's America's greatest pastime. You had a fairly great childhood. You know,
idyllic.
It was.
I think my childhood was idyllic. There were no pressures on me to be anything but a decent kid.
Yeah.
Be a decent kid. Do your stuff. My mom didn't put any heat on me to be in the academic program. Mm-hmm. I'm a flat average intellect who has a curiosity that really is voracious. I'm a big reader. My definition of IQ is being able to rapidly absorb and assimilate information. I'm not so good at that, but you can still keep putting stuff in there. And I love reading good writing and discovering things that I didn't know and connecting things that you didn't know connected. At the age of going on 75, that still fascinates the heck out of me.
Yeah. Now, you've really been on such a great team. I mean, you had such great friendships. And the people you write about are legends.
Yep.
I mean, people like Casey Stengel. Talk about your relationship with him.
Speaking of Stengelese, you know, became a language of its own. And Casey was, you know, back in the day where they were mostly writers he was talking to, but he was a man without an out cue, okay? And the reason, I think, was you can censor by deprivation, by limiting the amount of information, or you can censor by inundation.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you so much that you're not sure what you ask me or where the question resides in the information I give you back. Casey was the latter of those things. But I noticed when he was talking, when I showed up at spring training in 1964, and that was my first spring training, and I got to hang around big league spring training and be around Casey Stengel, and I played some spring training games in my very first outing as a professional player in 1964. And when Casey talked, I listened, and I thought I was hearing parables. In his stories, in these meandering, wandering diatribes that he might unleash on the writers, were little bits, golden little bits of information if you were an outfielder. He was a right fielder, and I was a right fielder. So there was stuff in there about hitting the cutoff man and how you prepare yourself, to play this game the right way. Little pieces in there all the time. And I felt like they were parables and I should listen.
And Gil Hodges is another. Your relationship with him wasn't always so easy.
It was a difficult relationship. I have and still have a fractious relationship with authority.
In general.
No, I do. And I don't know if it comes from the fact that somewhere in my neurobiology is this person who feels like if you don't respect what you don't know and don't question what you think you know, you're not doing it right. And all the really smart people I know sort of operate from that level,
Words to live by.
That method. Hodges was a former Marine, World War II, was in the Battle of Okinawa, which was actually a series of awful battles on the Japanese homeland. And I learned later on that way after it was too late, way after Gil had passed away, that he touched on Tinian Island in the Marianas in early March 1945 on his way to Okinawa. My father, who was a waist gunner in a B-29, landed on Tinian with his crew late March 1945. They were on the same island at different times.
Yeah.
I never knew that. I never related that to Gil. I couldn't. He was gone. But we butted heads, and I thought I had I thought I had sort of figured out the game a little bit. And Gil had this other way of doing things, and we grated on one another. And it's all on me, because all Gil Hodges ever wanted you to do was act like an adult and respect the game and play it the way you're supposed to. And, you know, I could do parts of that, but not all of it.
One of the things that's so interesting about this book is that you do have this great history-making moment that is yours and yours alone. But for most of the book, you're fairly self-deprecating about your abilities as a player.
I played against Willie Mays and Pete Rose and Johnny Bench and Willie McCovey and, you know, guys that when I was standing on the same diamond wearing a major league uniform, what was most clear to me was they were playing a game with which I had no clue about. Their ability to play and produce as major league players was on a level that I probably knew somewhere inside of me I would never arrive at, but I was going to struggle and be the best that I could be. That's all you could do. And in that struggle, there might be some beauty, but that's not the dominant sense you. The dominant sense you have is I better put it out every day. I got to work at it every day. And I'm fortunate to be here.
Well, we're fortunate you're here to tell this story,
thank
I have
you.
To say.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Ron Swoboda, whose new book is Here's the Catch, a memoir of the Miracle Mets and more. You can meet him Tuesday, June 11th at 6 at Octavia Books, Wednesday, June 12th at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie, and again Thursday, June 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Ron, thank you so much.
Susan, thank you so much. It's been fun.
Derby Gisclair is a baseball writer and sports historian who lives in New Orleans. Today, we're talking about two of his new books, The Olympic Club of New Orleans, Epicenter of Professional Boxing, 1883 to 1897, and Early Baseball in New Orleans, A History of 19th Century Play. Hi, Derby. Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, sports reveal so much about a city. You know, they reveal a character, and your books really celebrate that. So let's start with the Olympic Club and how you got interested in its history.
Well, my grandfather had actually instilled in me a love of boxing, watching the Gillette Friday night fights.
Uh-huh.
Such as that. And he was an ad man at the States Item. And so on Saturdays, he would turn in his copy and we'd go across the street to Curly's Neutral Corner and grab a bite. So boxing was always a part of it. But I was always a baseball fan. When I learned the story of the Olympic Club, it took me back to an entire different New Orleans.
Yeah.
A different time, a different place, with different customs and different diversions. And boxing was such a big part of that that it struck a chord in me. I said, this was a story that needed to be told.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began digging into it. And the more I dug into it, the more fascinating it became.
Well, and clubs like this are so important in the history of a city as well, because they do so much to organize society in a way. You know, it's so interesting the way names bleed over from book to book.
Exactly.
In your work. So tell us about the Olympic Club and where it was and what happened there.
Well, this is one of the great questions, because when people say, well, where was the Olympic Club? If I say it was at 417 Royal Street, they quicks up and look at you a little cross-eyed and say, it was at Brennan's? And I'm saying, no. And I never think of it as Brennan's. I always think of it as Paul Morphy's house.
Of course.
Well, that's the historian part of me. One of the great things, and we talk a little bit about it in the book, was Bernard Marigny's invention of the game of craps.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, everyone he taught the game played it better than he did. So he wound up having to sell off a lot of his land holdings to pay for his gambling debts. So they restarted the numbering system on Royal Street from Esplanade. So it was actually right near Washington Park was the mm-hmm. first iteration. Lasted about 3 years, and they outgrew that. So they moved up two more blocks, which is now the 3,000 block of Royal Street, between Montague and Clouet, and bounded by Charters. And that was where they had their greatest success, and that was where they had this beautiful four-story Victorian-looking clubhouse with this massive wooden arena, an indoor pistol shooting range, a gymnasium, a swimming center. I mean, it was an 11-building complex that took over most of that block.
And it was very elegant.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, imagine a sporting club, a gentleman's athletic club, with a library with 1,100 volumes.
That's what I want to know about, the library,
well,
of course.
This was, you know, the president of the club would go every day, he'd walk four blocks after dinner to spend time in his club.
Mm-hmm.
By and large, they would read. You know, the first floor was reading rooms. And, well, there was a tremendous appreciation for that at the time. I mean, mm-hmm. you didn't have some of the lesser diversions that you have nowadays.
So talk a little bit about how it was woven into the social fabric of the city. I mean, there were Mardi Gras matches, for example, that were very special.
Exactly.
And balls, all kinds of social events.
Well, when you think of all the clubs, most of them were built around diversions. The Boston Club, for instance, it was named for a card game. It was not named for the city. It was named for a card game. And it was a place where they could gather and play cards and mm-hmm. talk and have lunch and such as that. And it stayed very much a luncheon club, a social club. But it catered to one segment of society. The Olympic Club, and I talk a lot about it, it catered very much to the third district, which was immigrant-based, but it was developing exponentially. So the early members of the Olympic Club were merchants, clerks, bartenders, but the latter members in the height of it were ex-city councilmen, ex-mayors, attorneys, physicians, professional men who came from the third district. It's very, very much an immigrant-based growth. One of the guidebooks that the Times-Picayune used to put out, the Daily-Picayune at the time, talked about the third district as having some of the best duck hunting in the city. So it was very, very rural at the time.
Yeah, of course.
You know, but it built up, and all of these members formed the third district building association to help build their neighborhood and such as that. So it was quite a feat to have this club in this part of the city.
And how many members did they have at their height?
1,100.
That's a lot.
It's a tremendous number.
You know? And it was not only important to the life of New Orleans, but it was important on this whole boxing circuit.
Imagine if you can, having a building that could easily seat 10,000 people, that had a retractable roof, that was absolutely state-of-the-art lighting in terms of carbon arc lighting over the performance area, incandescent lighting throughout, telephone and telegraph.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not in current day. The New Orleans Smoothie King Center holds about 15,000 people. This was a building in 1890 with this. The two side streets to the complex, Montague and Clouet, weren't even paved at the time.
Whoa.
Royal Street and Charters were only cobble paved as far as Louisa Street.
Mm-hmm.
So it was still very, very much a neighborhood in development. And you had this facility drop down right in the middle of it. And people came, and I'm not exaggerating, people came from all over the world to fight there.
Important matches took place there.
At its height, you not only had one of these facilities, but you had three of these facilities. The Olympic Club was the only one that survived all of the assaults on boxing as a sport
mm-hmm.
Because they were so very, very successful.
It's like a whole hidden history.
Exactly.
That.
But it was not only boxing, it was all these other sports.
Well, and so we come to early baseball in New Orleans,
exactly.
too. And you began that book to search out the origins of the city's first baseball team, the New Orleans Pelicans.
Exactly. And one of the things that when I take a historical look at something, everything we know about the origin of baseball is a lie.
And you are here to fix that.
Well,
yes.
No, I'm not here to settle all of those arguments because Lord knows that would be voluminous. But, you know, most people, if you told them that Abner Doubleday did not invent baseball, they'd say, well, what do you mean? That's what I've always heard.
Of course, it is.
But he was a freshman at West Point when he was supposedly miraculously inventing baseball. And it comes down to a fellow by the name of Al Spalding, who was a sporting goods magnate, an ex-baseball player and quite a good pitcher at the time.
And a name we know today.
Exactly.
Still.
But he could not accept the fact that America's national pastime derived from a children's game, much less a British children's game. This was the great American pastime. And so while Alexander Cartwright has a plaque in the Hall of Fame as being the inventor of baseball, courtesy of his family who lobbied very hard, he was the member in charge of the Knickerbocker baseball mm-hmm. club that codified most of the rules. Baseball was the first game that Americans learned from a book. And if you look at the early etchings in Harper's or Frank Leslie's Illustrated, you'll see a fellow seated beneath an umbrella on the first base line. That was the umpire. He was there to read the book and let you know mm-hmm. what was and wasn't permissible. So the very first double play, well, can you do that? You know, because it was a game that doesn't resemble mm-hmm. what we play today. You could catch a ball on one hop and it would be out. I could be seated on the bench and a pop fly would come over to my way and I could stand up and say, now catching for New Orleans, just clear, catch the ball.
What and, a dream. What a
exactly.
dream. Right?
And then I would have to go in as catcher or whatever position I named myself. But you didn't have, you know, a lot of the rules that you had today. So the Knickerbocker Club codified that to say, no, it's not 40 paces between bases. My 40 paces and your 40 paces are going to be two different distances altogether. So they did 90 feet. And they made sure that it was is measured and exact. But again, it was a different game.
And you take us through baseball during the Civil War, for example. You talk a lot about how equipment was developed, baseball bats, for example, you mm-hmm. know, and balls. It's oddly fascinating. It's just oddly fascinating to me. You know what I mean?
Well, no, I do. And, you know, people ask me, you know, do I really like baseball that much? And I love baseball.
Yeah.
Not that I watch it unendingly on
of
TV.
Course.
That's not as much fun as going to the ballpark mm-hmm. and sitting with all the same folks that you always sit with, and you talk about the game. What do you think they're going to do here? Do you think they're going to send the runner? What pitch was that? All the nuances of the game and the strategy of the game. But when you look at the historical side of it, the home team used to have to, in the 19th century, used to have to provide three balls. And they might be of different size,
yeah.
and they might be of different shapes, and they might have different fillings and different coverings. Might have been horsehide, might have been cow's leather, might have been sheepskin.
Mm-hmm.
And if a ball went into the stands, well, you went and got it because you only had the three balls.
Yeah, exactly.
In a lot of places, there were no fences. So, you know, the ball would get past a fielder and keep rolling, but it was always in play. So then you have to think about the ball as it progressed during the game. The players would put tobacco juice and licorice
right.
juice and everything to keep their gloves soft. And so now you get this ball that wasn't very hard to begin with. And it goes around the infield in this mess. And it's like a black beanbag by the end of the game. And you had to be Man Mountain Dean to muscle that ball, you know, mm-hmm. over the outfielder's head because it was kind of like a beanbag. And it eventually got standardized and you had the stitches that you have now. But, you know, remember the old joke, you know, what's harder to handle, 2,000 pounds of feathers or 2,000 pounds of lead? Well, it's the same thing with a bat.
Mm-hmm.
Which is harder to hit with, a 48-ounce bat made of maple or a 48-ounce bat made of oak? Well, the maple bat's going to be so large to get enough density and weight
yeah.
in it. yet the oak bat's going to be compact and heavy and hard to swing. So there was constant experimentation with all of the tools. The original gloves that started out as just workman's gloves with the tips cut off.
Right.
Got into, you know, the catchers who got tired of breaking their fingers catching a ball with that, put a little padding into it, and then the catcher's mask came. And so the game evolved over a period of time. And it, not only the equipment, but the people who played it evolved over a period of time.
Fascinating. Fascinating. New Orleans is so full of stories. We'll never have them all.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, we've been talking with Derby Gisclair, author of The Olympic Club of New Orleans, Epicenter of Professional Boxing, 1883 to 1897, and Early Baseball in New Orleans, A History of 19th Century Play. You can meet him Thursday, June 13th at 6 when he discusses his work as part of the Second Thursday Series lectures, sponsored by the Friends of the Cabildo at the Jazz Museum in the Old Mint. Derby, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week here in New Orleans. Bar Redux at 801 Poland presents Writer's Gumbo, a celebration and sharing of words hosted by James Germain, with featured writers Jonathan Penton, Brianna Augustus, Joaquin Emiliano, Kathleen Conlon, Christopher Heffernan, Nicole Iden, Russell Mercado, and others. That's Sunday, June 9th at 8 p.m., again at Bar Redux at 801 Poland. Today's guest, Ron Swoboda, discusses and signs Here's the Catch, a memoir of the Miracle Mets and more. Tuesday, June 11th at 6 at Octavia Books, Wednesday, June 12th at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie, and again Thursday, June 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The second quarterly reading of Why There Are Words takes place Wednesday, June 12th at 6 at Octavia Books, curated and emceed by Liz Green. Featured writers include poet and essayist Nordette Adams, fiction writer Tom Andes, creative nonfiction writers Jesse Morgan Owens and Josie Scanlon, and poets Brad Richard and Rodrigo Toscano. Kristen Arnett celebrates the release of her debut novel, Mostly Dead Things, with Room 220. Wednesday, June 12th at 7 at the Saturn Bar, 3067 St. Claude Avenue. There will also be readings by Jamie Attenberg, Anne Giovanno, Christina K. Robinson, and Maurice Carlos Ruffin. Today's guest, Sherby Disclair, discusses the Olympic Club of New Orleans, Epicenter of Professional Boxing, 1883 to 1897, and Early Baseball in New Orleans, A History of 19th Century Play. Thursday, June 13th at 6. This is part of the Second Thursday Series lecture sponsored by the Friends of the Cabildo at the Jazz Museum in the Old Mint. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles, Saturday, June 15th at 10:30 a.m. at Octavia Books. And coming up, Bloomsday returns Sunday, June 16th at 11 a.m. at various venues around town. This annual reading of James Joyce's Ulysses is looking for those who like to read aloud. Check out the Facebook page, Bloomsday New Orleans 2019, for more information. Also on June 16th, the Maple Leaf Bar celebrates the 40th anniversary of the longest-running poetry series in the South on one of the most famous patios in New Orleans. John Travis's Portals Press issues a new anthology of work from Maple Leaf poets. Reading and signing Sunday at 3:30 at the Maple Leaf. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.